You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. It's brought to you by the barristers at One Crown Office Row, and this edition is presented by Rosalind English.
In our last episode, I spoke to Robert Spano, who's just started his tenure as President of the European Court of Human Rights. We discussed the role of government in our lives, particularly the role of government via automated decision-making. Robert pondered the challenge of how to accommodate the rule of law principles, which have been at the foundation of society since history began, when we move from human decision-making to automated tools. Of course, now the way we live our lives all over the world is being determined by our government's responses to the pandemic. We're all agog for ways out of the COVID lockdown, however tentative, and one of them is called the so-called contact tracing app, which was trialled in mid-May on the Isle of Wight with mixed results. My guest today is Professor Lillian Edwards, specialist in technology law at the University of Newcastle. She's drawn up a bill to protect the data privacy of citizens should contact tracing become a thing. Lillian, thank you so much for finding time in your hectic schedule to join us on LawPod UK. Can you explain to us how this app will work in a real-life situation?
Okay, one of the problems with explaining this is that the app is in constant development. So the information we have right now about the Isle of Wight trial is of a very early version of the app, which might change. So I'll talk in a kind of more broad brush way than the actual detailed functionality of the UK app, okay? So the problem with coronavirus, fundamentally, is that unlike a lot of previous infections that we've seen, perhaps most of the contagion occurs before symptoms are shown, right? So we know from the evidence now that there can be up to sort of 7 days in which people are asymptomatic but infectious. And in that time, they would wander around the world infecting people. So this is a challenge to conventional ways of dealing with pandemics, where someone reports symptoms, they get told to self-isolate, and you go and track down their contacts because there's been too long a period in which they've been infectious and asymptomatic. So that's what's driven, really, this global drive towards developing contact tracing apps, because the hope is that you can speed up this process of alerting people to isolate and also alerting their contacts to at least report symptoms and maybe to isolate as well. So that's roughly what these apps do. The big debate globally, in fact, and particularly in Europe, I think, right now, has been about how you build them, because you're fundamentally talking about people sharing really quite sensitive data and perhaps their name, perhaps other details about themselves. So there's a global kind of sliding scale from the apps we've seen in Asia, such as Hong Kong and China and Singapore, where an enormous amount of personal data about people is collected, not just from them, but also from sources such as social media or even credit reports, and is used in a kind of big pile of data to get instructions to them and trace them and track them and do various types of social control. Now, when the idea of these apps got to Europe, I think people said as one, we can't do it that way. It's too big a privacy invasion. And that's not just an abstract concept. That means that people won't trust the app. They'll be scared. A lot of people have got things that they'd rather the government doesn't know. That might not be about illegality. They might be worried, perhaps unreasonably, that it'll prejudice their immigration status or maybe their employment issues. Maybe they're self-employed and they're worried that something will come out. So lots of people would have reasons not to trust a very privacy invasive app, even on top of the fact that it would be illegal under data protection law and also Article 8 of the European Convention on Human Rights. And that's what's led the European countries to try to look for less privacy invasive solutions. So the main solution is not to use, for example, GPS or phone location or names or addresses, but simply to use Bluetooth, which tells you if your phone has been near another phone when they both have Bluetooth on. So proximity tracing, it's a new kind of data that these apps are dealing with, proximity data. They can know that you were near a potentially infected person without knowing where you were. And that's very, very useful in privacy terms.
That's very helpful, broad picture of the different kinds of approaches across the globe. But Lillian, we've gone down at the moment, gone down what's called a centralized system. Could you explain the difference between centralized and decentralized approach?
Yeah, I'll try, though I should say I'm not a techie, okay? But this has been an enormous debate ever since the Bluetooth approach, which was trialed in Singapore, in fact worked very well in Singapore, has come over to Europe. So one way of doing it, which is what the NHSX in the UK has gone with, is what they call centralized, which would mean that I would supply data, I would either self-report symptoms, or maybe I would even report that I'd had a test and been positive. And that information would be conveyed to a central server that the government has access to, that NHSX controls, or Public Health England controls. There are issues there about who is the actual data controller. Now, that information might not be, again, explicit in the way it sounds. It might involve a pseudonymous identifier, is what they're using, and it's very pseudonymous, but it is a permanent identifier, so it does mean that going forward in the future, you can, in some clever way, be tracked by the government, and that's what worries people. So the central server is used for various things, such as assessing the worth of the data that you've given. They're going to build in risk scoring, as it's called, to try. If you're providing self-reported symptoms, there's quite a high chance that they're wrong, you know, that you've got it wrong, maybe maliciously because you're trying to mess things up, or maybe just because you're a hypochondriac or you're worried, and we're all in a situation where we think, oh my God, have I got coronavirus? Yeah. Or it might be that people think this is a way to get a test more quickly. There's all kinds of reasons why that data might be poor. So one of the reasons to have a centralized system, if you're using self-reported symptoms, is that within the central server, you can then do what they call risk scoring. So you could say, it's unlikely that person's infected because actually they've only been in contact with three people and for only 10 minutes, you know, so you could do that kind of thing. However, there is an alternative approach, which is the decentralized approach. And that was worked out by a European consortium called DP3T, a very small, very brilliant consortium. And then that approach was largely, as I understand it, picked up by Apple and Google, who came in and said, right, we will build an API, a programming interface, that means that decentralized apps can run on our phones, which of course is most of the market, within our operating system, and therefore that runs quite efficiently. And the advantage of that is that in the decentralized approach, the phone talks to the phone, right? So the phone of me says, I'm within 2 meters of, say, Roz for over 15 minutes. That's a potential contact if I'm an infected person. But that data is only held on our respective phones. So the data is held locally. There is no central server. There is no central risk scoring. And this is one of the reasons, as I understand it, that pushed NHSX towards deciding that they would go with a centralized solution, because at the time that they started to design the system, we didn't have enough tests. In fact, we had very few tests, and they were only really being used in hospitals. Therefore, it was almost a no-brainer at that point that they designed it around a self-reported symptoms model, unsatisfactory as that is in the ways I've just described. So that's what led them to go down a centralized route. But other countries have perhaps, I don't know, started a little later or had different circumstances or had more access to testing. And therefore, they adopted largely most countries in Europe now have adopted the Google Apple decentralized model, because the evidence seems to be that it works better because it's built into the phones in a way that the Google and Apple have kind of specified. It is probably better in terms of just efficiency, things like battery life and actually working. But the other advantage, obviously, is that it's much, much more privacy preserving. In fact, it's really ideally 100% privacy preserving, because that data, this really sensitive proximity data, which is essentially everyone you've ever talked to or met or been near, never goes to the central server, never goes near the NHS or the government. And the last thing I've sort of say on that is, as I say that, you can hear another alleged advantage, because I'm not a scientist, so I can't prove it. But the other advantage that is touted for the centralized system is that because it's giving the government this pile of central data, they can use it very effectively for epidemiology. So you're looking beyond simple one-to-one or one-to-many contact tracing, and you're looking towards understanding better the patterns of the disease, so you can do things about it, like why do hotspots develop, or is it worse if there's 13 people in this particular place? So that kind of data is apparently available more via the centralised system than the decentralised system, and that's been claimed by NHSX and the Oxford epidemiologists advising them to be a big advantage of the centralised system. I mean, one thing I'd just say there is, although I said there were advantages to the centralised system, I didn't say it was advantageous, if you see what I mean, because you have to take those advantages, assess whether they could also be supplied by the decentralised model, which is not entirely clear, and there is very conflicted advice on it. And then you have to say, even if there are these epidemiological advantages, do they outweigh the substantial worries about privacy? And that's why, since NHSX, at the time I started writing, April the 13th, seemed wedded to the centralised approach, that's when I thought we really must have legal safeguards here. If we're not going to have code safeguards, which is what the decentralised model gives you, we must have stringent legal safeguards.
I'm just thinking about the problem of basic human psychology. I mean, what's in it for me? Why should I take up this app and have it on my phone? There's no advantage to me as an individual. People are selfish. I'm selfish. How do we get around that basic problem?
Well, I think that's really a question for a behavioural psychologist. But there is kind of really heartening evidence, I think, from the experience of the pandemic that people do care about society, or maybe less metaphorically. They care about their parents, they care about their grannies and their aunts and so forth, right? So I think people have got a consciousness that stopping spread, which is what contact tracing apps are designed for, will help all their friends and family to get out of isolation and quarantine. You know, I'm very aware of it myself. My 88-year-old mother is sitting in quarantine, essentially in seclusion in Glasgow and going slightly around the bend, you know. So I think people do understand that. The evidence from the Isle of Wight trial so far, which it has to be said is a very artificial trial in lots of ways, is, you know, really positive. You know, there's a population there of, I think, about 110,000, 120,000 people. And they had 30,000 downloads in the first day, which is a quarter of the people on the Isle of Wight. And I think since then, estimates kind of vary. They've had between 40 and 50% of the population have downloaded. Now, the thing is, what they say, what the epidemiologists say, is you need 80% of the smartphone-using population to make this a really good exercise. If you get a lower percent, it might help, but for a kind of optimum functionality, you want 80% of smartphone users. And since 20% of people don't have smartphones, though that varies by demographic, that gets you down to about 60% of the population. So they've since kind of downgraded that bit. I don't quite know why, and said 50% would do. So now the Isle of Wight downloads in the trial appear to be approaching the point that you really wanted for this to work. However, it has to be said that there are a lot of caveats on that, because one of the things they did was, you know, they didn't, you just have to put in an Isle of Wight postcode, and you can find that on Google. So the suspicion is that quite a lot of journalists and interested people like me might have downloaded it who aren't on the Isle of Wight. So this might be a slightly misleading statistic. However, it's positive. It is very positive.
So given that we've got this semi-successful trial behind us, let's move on, Lillian, to your bill and address some of the concerns that you have about privacy. You've referred to that before, and how your bill is, and indeed the Australian legislation that's already gone through, will perhaps cope with these concerns.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for that. Well, as I say, that's the background. is that back in April, it appeared that we were heading towards a centralised solution. And I was really seriously worried that however good it was for society, as it were, long term, it might have really, really bad privacy implications. As I say, these implications are not totally clear because they are using, you know, these persistent pseudonymous identifiers. So more information would have to be added for this to become a kind of future surveillance tool. But that's not that difficult. So that's why I became worried. So the pat answer, or the answer to this from Matt Hancock so far, has been, we've got data protection, we're fine. And one of the things I sat down to do was almost a sort of gap analysis of, was data protection sufficient? And I don't think it is. So one point, for example, is now we have an app. I mean, at the point I was writing, it was hypothetical. But we're going to have an app. It's going to be rolled out. You know, they're saying 1st of June. I wonder if it won't be a little bit later, but we're definitely going to have an app. And at that point, when we're trying to get people back to work and into, you know, the economy, what's going to happen? That's what worried me. Because, again, NHS and NHSX have repeatedly said, oh, this will be voluntary, nobody will be forced to do it, which is what you'd expect. But what happens when your employer says you're not coming to work unless you install the app? And maybe you're very disempowered. Maybe you're a 0 hours worker or a gig worker or in a call centre and you really don't have any bargaining power, yeah? And you've got reasons, as I've already said, reasons which may be reasonable but are legitimate not to want to install the app. And, you know, the evidence we're getting is that around 14 to 20% of the population may feel that way. That ties in with long-standing privacy research, which generally shows that about 20% of the population are very privacy sensitive, almost privacy fundamentalists. So at that point, what happens when your employer says, you're not coming unless you've got the app installed and show me your phone? Or indeed, when the employer says, show me your phone and let me see if you've had any instructions to self-isolate or any instructions just to be careful. So there's two issues going on there, right? One, you say, that's great. You know, that's protecting society and protecting the workplace. Yippee. On the other hand, as you can see, it might be discriminatory towards people who haven't installed the app, and also to people who have but feel that they might be vulnerable. So this would be an easy way to get rid of workers you don't like, or workers whose skin colour you didn't like, or people you just want to get rid of without paying redundancy payments to. So you can imagine all kinds of scenarios here. And again, I'm not an employment lawyer, so I can't say that maybe some aspects of employment law don't cover it. But my worry was that we would see discrimination and coercion. These are the two phrases I've banged on about. And that really is not covered by data protection. And as far as I can tell, it's not really covered by other bits of the law either. You might say discrimination, ooh, that falls under the Equality Act. But if you look up the Equality Act, it doesn't have either health or naturally virus status as a protected characteristic. And you're only protected against discrimination on the grounds of a protected characteristic. So going back to data protection, having talked to quite a lot of people about this, I do not see it covering it. I mean, data protection ideally includes a principle of fairness. So it's not just lawfulness, which gets talked a lot, that you have to have a legal basis for processing. It's also that processing has to be fair, and that takes you on to transparency and all kinds of stuff like that. You could read the kind of worries I'm talking about into fairness, but I think that's very uncertain, and I wouldn't want to leave it there. And indeed leave the regulator in that place. So that was my first big consideration, was that we needed to have a rule, which is what I included in my bill, and which I think got picked up in the Australian Act, that no one should be coerced by either a private sector person, such as an employer, or a public sector person, because you can also imagine app status being used to, say, restrict whether you're allowed to go to your GP's surgery. Can imagine it being used by people to stop you going into public facilities, or to stop you using public transport, or to stop you going to a football stadium. There's so many avenues here. So I said, no coercion. There should be no incentives, requirements that you mandatorily install the app or share data from the app. And there is indeed a very similar provision in the Australian app that you mentioned that came out a few weeks back to accompany the Australian app.
I think that there's so many things that have come out of this pandemic and the consequent lockdown. But this is very, very important. We've only just, as citizens, got used to data protection and the regime surrounding that. And now this massive data pickup and possible coercive measures to share private data seems to ram straight against it. It's rather ironic, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a huge challenge and coming relatively soon after the GDPR. If we look at enforcement of the privacy worries that I'm talking about, if you put them within a data protection regime solely, you're throwing it onto the existing regulators to handle it. But they're already going down for the third time just with the GDPR. The Irish DPC, for example, has got 20 actions on its desk against Google, Facebook, et al., and hasn't managed to resolve any of them yet, hasn't managed to fine anybody, and that's been going on for like over 2 years. So then to say that they should have the regulatory burden of dealing with these apps and their novel worries, I think is, well, unreasonable, too optimistic, shall we say. So one of the suggestions I've made in the bill again is that there be a different system of oversight, that there be some kind of coronavirus safeguards commissioner. And I note that that's very much been picked up also in the draft bill from the Joint Human Rights Committee that is sitting again on Matt Hancock's desk right now. And the other reason for doing that, beyond simply the capacity of the regulator, is that, as I've been trying to say, the range of issues here is much wider than data protection. It's about discrimination and autonomy and freedom of movement and due process. And these are all things where obviously the ICO can get advice, but it's not their core regime. So I think we do need a new commissioner that would oversee all of the kind of human rights and due process issues around the app, and indeed, as we go forward, the track and trace strategy, because it's becoming a wider, more integrated thing.
Well, Lillian, I mean, I'm very grateful for you giving us these pointers to the larger issues behind this app. It's very easy, as I have done, and I think many people have done, to get bogged down in the technical details without thinking of the larger picture. I do hope that your concerns are met in legislation, and I completely understand what you're saying about overburdening the current regulators. So thank you very much for enlightening us on this difficult and urgent subject.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for asking me.
LawPod UK is presented by Rosalind English and is produced by One Crown Office Row. For more editions of LawPod UK, you can subscribe to the podcast and recommend us to a friend.